Thank you. Are you an animal
or a person? We just heard were spoken by the gorilla Coco to the human being Penny Patterson. Let's look at those words from the point of view of the way a world looks to a culture critic. And let's take culture apart like these balls of yarn. First, I'd like to explain the principle that I use in looking at the production of modern culture. Seems to me the cultural critic is faced by a world that looks very much like tangled balls of yarn. And that one way to approach the situation is to pull on a thread and begin to untangle the ball of meanings, and begin to trace through one thread and then another what gets to count as nature, for whom and when, and how much it costs to produce nature at a particular moment in history for a particular group of people. For a particular group of people. Another way to imagine the same situation is to take a layer cake, Pepperidge Farm layer cake, formerly boycotted because of the Nestle bottle feeding scandal, to take a layer cake and cut into history as if it were a layer cake, and begin to unpack the layers of meanings.
Stop!
unpack the layers of meanings of all of the pleasures and all of the problems that these layers of meanings produce for the historian and the culture critic. So let's go back to Penny Patterson and Coco and the problem of the talking gorillas and the African chimpanzees in the first world in this mythic time called the late 20th century. Is Coco the gorilla taking a picture of herself in the mirror with a Japanese camera. And what we see is the gorilla with the attribute of self-reflection, self-vision. The gorilla with a Japanese tourist camera sees herself in the mirror and takes her own picture. She's in charge of her own image. She represents universal life.
Hello, this is Yem Gel on NTS2. My selections today might have something to do with my reading lots of Ursula Le Guin recently. I think I'm sort of seeing her atmospheres and her creative politics, I guess, in things more. First we've heard two pieces of my own, both of which are still growing. The first one is called Crocus Scape Hiker. The second one is called Softbank. And then next we heard Susumu Yokota with The Plateau, which the Zephyr of Flora occupies. Then we heard Flora Yin Wong with a track called Lugier, and that's off the really, really good recent Pan compilation. Then we heard Hildegard von Bingen with O Tu Suavisa Virga, over which I was playing some sections of speech from Donna Haraway. And that was from a sick public access TV broadcast, which I found on YouTube, which you can find on YouTube. It's called Donna Haraway Reads National Geographic's Coverage of Primates, or something like that. She's unraveling National Geographic's coverage of Coco the gorilla. And finally, we just heard Meredith Monk with Fields and Clouds. I was playing some wolves over the top of that too. So up next is Biosphere with Hyperborea.
Carefree.
book, the camera, naming the animals. The gorilla who says, fine animal gorilla, when she was asked if she's an animal or a person. Who is this universal man who is separated from every history? First of all, Coco the gorilla is born in San Francisco Zoo. How does she come to be the companion of the psychology graduate student at Stanford, Penny Patterson? And how is it that Penny Patterson gets to keep her? One of the first things to remember is that zoos are able to have these endangered animals only if they somehow get themselves involved in helping these animals to reproduce, in reproductive politics that are part of conservation politics. So the mayor of San Francisco, the politicians of San Francisco, people who speak for science, people who speak for nature, get involved. Politics in the Silicon Valley, in the Los Altos Hills. Let's turn from the Penny Patterson Coco story to another scene of the traffic across nature and culture. This time, let's look at Indonesia, and let's look at another cover of the National Geographic magazine, this time with Berute Galdikas and two orangutan orphans clinging to the maternal body of science-coded female. We have in this situation a scientist, Berute Galdikas, teaching kidnapped infants from the wild how to be wild. These are infants who were taught by the human being to return to nature. And if we look at the other picture, we see Berute Galdikas' son, Binti, in a plastic bathtub with one of the orangutan orphans, Princess, taking a bath together. And in the story between Binti and Princess, we learn that the orangutan princess teaches the human child, Binti, his first human word in American Sign Language, while Binti's natural mother is teaching Princess how to be wild. We also learn that Berute Galdikas' favorite orangutan rehabilitant or orphan, Sujito, has at adolescence fallen in love with Berute Galdikas and needs to be relocated in the forest, far distant from the scene of the rehabilitation of the orphans, lest his out-of-control libidinal love for his mother, his illegitimate and incompletely, phallically, Oedipally reorganized love for his mother, interfere with the traffic across nature and culture. Hey. In Silicon Valley, in the Los Altos Hills. Let's turn from the Penny Patterson Coco story to another scene of the traffic across nation and culture. This time, images of the traffic across that sacred boundary between nature and culture abound. For example, we have here in American history of portrait and photography, a family, middle-class American family of the youth and afternoon. The family consists of a French blonde woman, a black man, two chimpanzee children, and a human child of ambiguous ethnic identity. This is the kind of species, racial decoding that we find in modern American culture. We have also a greeting card of this strange 1950s television family. Unmarried couple, Tarzan and Jane, their adopted child, boy, and their strange chimpanzee daughter. We have the family that exists at the boundary between nature and culture, and we need to ask, why these boundary objects, why this particular moment in history? This particular moment in history deals with two particularly important world-changing events. One of them is decolonization. But the question we have to ask in the wilds of Tanzania is, what exactly does it cost to put a white virgin blonde woman in this strange sacred place called the wilds of Tanzania in 1960? What does it cost to be alone in nature the year that the Belgian Congo becomes the Republic of the Congo, and Jane Goodall on her way to the scenes of intimacy with the wild chimpanzees in the Gombe Stream Preserve, the scenes of intimacy that have become part of television life, part of the touch with nature, from the first world to the third world. What does it cost to be alone in nature as Jane Goodall and her mother stop on the shores of the lake before taking the boat to the Gombe Stream and make 2,000 Spam sandwiches for fleeing Belgium, the year of the independence of the Republic of the Congo?
For most, this would be a lonely, forbidding realm.
It was wrapped up in bubble wrap because it's a very structural kind of shoe. And
So since I last spoke, we've heard a piece called Hazmizu Vatane by Ensemble Tirana, and then there was Fish by Monoton, and then we heard Gaino Yamashiro Gumi with Primordial Germination, and then we had lastly Organum with Incarnate. And again, I was playing sections of Donna Haraway over the top of that. So to finish today, I'm going to play us out with a piece called On the Other Ocean by David Behrman.
sounds maybe better. But what does it take for humans to survive? I think we've been arguing in that sim way that it's going to take more than humans imagined autonomously, but entangled in multi-species worlds. But the landscapes that we're a part of are not just backgrounds or aesthetic objects. We need the other players with us in making these worlds to be active and creative and to be part of making the same kinds of projects that we will also respond to. And we need them to respond to opportunities, including human trouble. I'm going to use the word disturbance, and I hope it doesn't upset you too much. A disturbance just means relatively quick ecological change. It's not necessarily bad. It's not necessarily human. Fires and floods are disturbances, and so too is human farming. When other living beings come back in the face of disturbance, I'll call that resurgence. Cut down a forest and it grows back again. That's resurgence. Drain a wetland and don't maintain the drains, it becomes a wetland again. That's resurgence. My main argument in this section is that we need resurgence. We can't survive without it. We're in trouble to the extent that we block resurgence. And there's a particular kind of resurgence, too, that might be a guide. And I'm going to call it Holocene resurgence, after the geological epoch following the last ice age, when the Earth's climate warmed and stabilized. This is also the time of the spread of human farming. Now, the Holocene was not the world in natural harmony. Humans already had extinguished many of the big animals, the ones we now call megafauna. But compared to the present, we had an array of other life forms that our species managed to live with in the midst of farming. And we might want to appreciate that now that we're doing much less well. So what this slide shows is the last glacial maximum about 18,000 years ago. The world was full of ice and deserts. When the ice retreated and the world got warmer and wetter, plants and animals moved into new places, taking advantage of opportunities. And I think we don't appreciate the ability of plants in particular to move around very much. And we should, because that's the basis of what I'm calling resurgence. Covered the land or dried landscapes into deserts, forests retreated. When the ice melted and the rains returned, forests extended themselves. That's Holocene resurgence. Farmers depend on forest resurgence. I learned this first in my research in Indonesia, where I worked with shifting cultivators in the rainforest. Fields were left to grow into forest. Forest made it possible to clear new fields. But this has been equally true for temperate farmers with permanent fields. Until industrialization, farmers with animals used the forest to feed their animals. Farmers without animals used green manure gathered from the forest to keep their fields fertile. So this slide shows the Satoyama landscape in Japan, a landscape of rice paddies and surrounding village forests. Forests made possible farming here. Farmers gathered forest stuff to fertilize their fields. They also gained life necessities from the village forest, from firewood and charcoal to vegetables, nuts, and mushrooms. Fungi and trees worked together to come back as farmers cleared forests.